That openness to what might happen is a very scary thing for some people. That's why some creative types end up with these very big egos, because they think if it's not my way, it's broken. Hi.
Hi, everyone. I'm Angela, and this is Austin.
And this is Brushes and Keys. How are you?
Very hot.
Yeah, LA is brutal.
Yeah, not as brutal as London.
I mean, it was humid. I just got back from London, for anyone listening that doesn't, like, lest it sound like we just randomly monitor the weather in other cities. I was just in London.
Yeah, Austin was telling me how hot the day was.
Yeah. It was very humid. I felt very sweaty and disgusting when I was supposed to look very fancy. And,
actually, yes, that I know that LA is very, very hot, but I am so grateful that it's not humid, because that combo is just death.
Yeah. It's very rare. Every now and again, randomly, it will get humid here, but we are technically a desert. So that, yeah, I agree. I can handle heat to a point. Years ago, 12, 13, 14 years ago, not that long after I moved here, we had one summer that had this one week that was the most insane heat wave I've ever felt in my entire life. And so much so that the electrical grid, like the transformer box that unites a bunch of different power lines under the street for my block that I was living in Los Feliz at the time, it melted in the heat, and like 50 houses and apartments and stuff just lost power for like a week in the middle of that heat.
Ew.
And it was one of those where there was no breeze, so you couldn't open your window to like let wind through or something. If you opened your window, it just filled your house or apartment with hot air.
Yeah.
It was mind-blowing. It was literally 120 degrees outside.
Jesus.
And yeah.
I think I felt something similar, but not 110, just probably 100-ish something, but never 10.
That's almost 50 Celsius for our non-American friends.
Mm-hmm.
And or our smart American friends, because Celsius is such a more sensible scale. I hate to be that guy, because it's such a cliche thing to be like, oh, stupid Fahrenheit and the imperial measurements. Why do we say miles instead of kilometers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's true. I can't help it. It's true. In any case.
Are you ready for today's topic?
Yes. What are we discussing?
We are last minute discussing relationships.
My understanding, or at least my focus on that in this case, this is not like dating advice. It is creative partnerships.
Yes.
Which obviously is certainly a big part of our
dynamic. I bet from
now
on we're just going to have less listeners.
I don't know. I'd like to believe that that's part of what people are listening
for. Oh, yeah, for sure.
I would hope. I maybe that's naive.
It's not intended for those audiences. But yeah.
Yes, exactly. I have a million things I can talk about.
I know. I love it.
Along that line. But I'm curious what... Because this... For those listening, we have a document where we kind of... Anytime we get an idea of something that could be interesting to discuss, we add it to our list for future episodes. And this is definitely one that you added on there, I'm pretty sure. And I'm curious if you had something specific in mind.
I actually don't remember if I added this one before, but I just felt like doing it today because I couldn't think of anything else. It's all super last minute since Austin has been traveling and we haven't even talked about what to do on this episode. So I was like, you know what? Let's talk about relationships. Let's talk about our work.
I mean, it's a very universal.
Working with other people and in every field. Not necessarily work, but just doing projects together. And I think I think that we have plenty of stories to tell on this one.
Do you have a favorite example that is not related to us, like
an example of a great relationship,
like of a creative collaboration that, you know, just really stands out as something that was awesome or inspiring, or
I don't know, Paul McCartney and Michael Jackson.
I meant you personally.
Lovely song, super cheesy song called "That Girl's Mine."
Well, okay, that's good to know. That's a totally different thing than I was. I meant you and your work.
I see.
Like what I kind of was imagining was, you've worked with a bunch of different photographers, for example, and like we recently did a thing with Alf, and you've done some stuff with him.
That's
a really great creative partnership. I would put forward
because
that one the character from I can't remember because it's a game I never played, but the thing with the guitar from Tom.
You know, Guilty Gear. Yeah, we did that
from Guilty Gear.
That was the first photo shoot we did together, and I actually was quite surprised that we did that because I moved here. Obviously, I didn't know anybody in the community, cosplay community or anything like that. And I was like over the moon when he was like, let's do something together, you know, because it was a funny interaction because he was commenting on my photos on Instagram and I checked his work and I loved it immediately. And so I started following and then I realized he is living in LA and He didn't know I was living in LA. He thought I was still in Costa Rica.
Funny. I forgot that.
And he told me he started following my work years ago, you know, like, I don't know, like 8 years ago or something, like when I did Elizabeth.
Yeah. The BioShock stuff.
So, yeah, that was a long time ago. I don't even remember. But he thought I was in Costa Rica, and so yeah, I was like, nope, I'm here, let's do something together. And he was like, hell yeah. And yeah, that happened. And you were there, you came with us to the photo shoot.
Oh,
and
I held the reflector a couple of times, and yeah, it was so interesting because I've been your sort of fake photographer a few times. And I am not a photographer. I'm like, I don't really know how to optimally use a proper fancy camera. I rely on a lot of the automated settings, which on a good modern camera is surprisingly effective, but in the hands of a professional who can ask for something very precise from the camera, they can do things that are just 1,000% beyond what I'm able to do. I've never had the time to really kind of like properly learn it. I mean, it's a whole art form. It would be like learning, it would be like out going, I just kind of want to learn how to write music. It's like,
right.
Oh, okay. I've spent my whole life learning this thing. You're not likely to catch up to what I know, and I'm never going to catch up to what you know.
Right.
But like, you know, I could give you some pointers that if you want to have fun with it, you could probably
exactly.
be a little more effective. And you know, I've learned a few things along those lines. But it was so interesting because my strategy has always been, I'm just going to shoot 5 million photos and hope that like 1%
yeah.
are good, which
yeah.
means that if I shoot enough, there'll be like 20 or 30 that you like
mm-hmm.
out of
it
literally
works,
like 300.
It works,
but it also means that you develop a rhythm where you're kind of like always moving poses and you're kind of like shifting up. Cause you know, I'm
yeah.
almost filming
yeah.
like a movie practically.
Yeah.
I'm shooting so rapidly and constantly that you know, if you just hold position forever, you're going to get 90 photos that look the same.
Mm-hmm.
So you know to move. And he's the exact opposite.
Yeah.
It was like watching a Jedi where he would close his eyes
yeah.
for like 30 seconds. I almost felt like he fell asleep. It was so long. He would close his eyes
yeah,
and then go, okay.
He's like a monk.
Yeah.
Literally.
And he would have very precise. He'd go and he had like a little, remote activated floodlight that he would go and put like 40 feet behind you, and then he would, you know, position the reflector over here and like the flash maybe up here, and you know, build this very specific composition. He'd lay on the ground at some awkward angle in order to get this very precise thing that he thought would look interesting, and he'd sort of hold position and it put you can't collaborate with someone like that the same as with me as
oh,
a result
for
because
sure,
if you're
yeah.
moving all the time, he would sit there and I was so inspired by it because I was like, wow, it's so cool.
Yeah.
To and it really
he
made
like
me feel.
He built the whole thing on his head and then he replicates, but it takes a little bit of time to do that.
Yes, exactly.
In real life.
He very methodically
yeah.
moves the pieces into position and then he's like, I need you to do this. And he'll tell you very specifically, you know,
yeah.
lower your head a little, move
yeah.
your hand this and bit. And then there's like the science and then just click. One,
and that's
one
it.
Shot.
That's it.
And then you look at it, and it's
yeah,
like a
it's perfection.
Yeah, blew my mind. Yeah. It was so, it was so cool. All the work
for one shot, and it's just like, I don't know, it's phenomenal.
Yeah, it really is. And it I think it's a good example of this whole concept of the creative partnerships, because you, as the like the model, mm-hmm. have to be very different.
You have to act as model also.
We did do, yes, our awesome Addams Family shoot, and it was the same. He was the exact same, and I remember feeling like I was his prop. He would be like, can you lower your hand 1 inch? Can you do this? And I would have to hold this position, and I'd start to get like sore, because I felt I'm sitting here frozen for so long.
Oh, yeah.
And then finally he takes it, and we saw the photos, and I was like, holy crap, it's almost as if I'm a cosplayer.
You did a great job, by the way. Yeah,
it's all in the photographer, I swear.
But also, yeah, no, I think it's everything together. You looked very good with your hair and the beard, you know, gone. Very handsome looking, and Alf did
the first time. So good. This was the level of my dedication. This was talk about creative partnership. That was the first time I had actually shaved with a razor and hot water, like shave close to the skin to be truly clean shaven without just shortening the beard like a trimmer.
It was lovely.
Since 2008.
Holy shit.
It was the first time I had been, because I look like I'm 12. In
2008, I made my first Bioshock cosplay. That was the big sister.
Man, people should all go look that up on your your Bermudas Instagram.
Anyway,
the secondary Instagram account.
Yeah, that was good. Cool. You learn so much with just doing a little fun thing with somebody else that you're not used to. It's awesome.
Oh yeah, there's been a lot of that. Like I get this a lot in my line of work in general, because I work with musicians, and you know, like if I write a line for cello and I give it to someone like Tina, and then I give it to a different cellist, they're going to play it differently, even if they're reading the sheet music as exactly as they can manage, which of course is never the case, because I also invite them to bring their personality to it and not just try to be a robot. And but it's amazing how different these things can be. Mm-hmm. But I've gotten a really strong dose of it the last 6 months working with this incredible cast on this musical game, Stray Gods, where, you know, we spent years writing these songs with the Tripod Boys down in Australia, where we're trying to make a very neutral version of the song. Like it's supposed to just be like a guitar or a piano and a singing voice. We're not like demonstrating too much about what final genre it could be or any of that stuff. Is it super electronic? Is it like a Bob Dylan, just person and a guitar? Like what kind of musical execution will the final product? We intentionally save that step for later so that the actor who ends up singing the role can really help determine what it will be in the end by bringing their own ideas and their own personality. And as much as I understand how much that creative partnership can change the final result, it has been still such a revelatory experience, because like we had a session this morning, can't say who any of the cast are because it's all still secret other than Laura Bailey, who has been unbelievable. But we've had a lot of other unbelievable casts as well. We had one today. It was our first session with this particular cast member. So I had never met them before this morning, mm-hmm. other than one email we exchanged. And I didn't know what to expect. I knew who they were by their reputation and by their work, but I never worked with them.
Like,
and so we had this.
Can I have a little like a TV? Is it video games? Is it?
They've been in both very well known games and very well known TV shows. Mm. And everybody that I know who knows them personally, which is a fair amount of people, they all love this guy. Everyone always had good things to say about him. Mm. And he's obviously good. Mm-hmm. As a normal actor, but a musical is a different beast. Mm. And this was just, you know, trust that he could do a great job and bring something interesting to the mm-hmm. character. And so we start the call explaining how the game works, how the singing works, all that kind of stuff, like the game mechanics.
Uh-huh.
And then explain the whole concept that, like, the backing track is very temporary. It's meant to not push you somewhere so that you feel you can do something with it. You know, like we spend, you know, the first like 20 minutes just talking.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole time his face, I was really like obsessively studying his face, trying to work out. Is he nervous? Is he into this? Sometimes people look so afraid because it's a big, you know, like there's people who go, look, I can sing, but like, I'm not a singer.
Right.
So they really feel vulnerable stepping into a job like this. And I was kind of getting that vibe from him where I was like, I think he feels a little apprehensive about this, but he's got a kind of a poker face. I just don't know what he's thinking. And so then finally, he does his first take. And it was like, after all this conversation, and Troy and I just look at each other and we're like, fuck, like we could just move on. It's like, we don't even need a second take.
That's awesome.
It was so amazing. And it was different. It was totally different than I had pictured the character. That was the thing that was so exciting, where it was like, oh man, you made that word quiet. It's like you made the character sound hurt about this part and angry about this part. And in my mind, it was the opposite. But now that makes me think of this and that. And I was so, and anyway, it's very apropos this topic of like the players who play the game, hopefully there will be many of them, will get this thing and never know all the thousands of other ways it might have gone. And if it was just me alone, it would be really, really different. And the fact that it's not me alone, it's this intersection of all these different creative people. I live for that. I love that it's things that I could never, like, my God, what Tripod brought to it as songwriters. Mm-hmm. There's so much, never mind the lyrics, there's so many melodies and all kinds of things that they would suggest and we'd play with, or they just wrote it and then I would kind of finish it. And like, it's such a combined brain. It's sort of the essence of Dialogos in that way. Like, you know, when we do that, neither of us would ever have done what we did.
Absolutely.
If it was
not.
Just I'm gonna play piano for 30 minutes, like it would just never. Why would I suddenly get dark or light and happy or what, like all those things? I would never make those choices without something to look at and go, oh, that I can see where she's going.
It's so fun. It's fun, but also starting something like that with somebody else that you're not used to, it's very, very scary. But yes, you're not used to that and you don't know what is going to happen. And that's the exciting part. Even if it don't go well, at least you know now what is it going to be next time, you know, and how to improve or whatever.
100%. That openness to what might happen is a very scary thing for some people. That's why some creative types end up with these very big egos, because they think if it's not my way, it's broken.
Right.
And Spielberg is the perfect example of somebody that, you know, has very famously said comments. I'm not quoting him directly because I don't remember the exact quote, but it's something along the lines of, you know, I want to be the least smart person in the room of the team I gather. You know what I mean? Like, I want the cinematographer, and like Janusz Kaminski in the case of Steven Spielberg, to be a far better cinematographer than I could ever be. You know, I want John Williams to be a far better composer than I could ever be, or Michael Kahn an editor, or you know, all these figures that he works with. He's like, as the team leader, I want to be able to go to my sort of department heads. You know,
How cool is that? How cool is just to surround yourself with like extremely talented and awesome people? I didn't know how that will feel until I met you, your way to do things and your way to see life. And ever since I met you, I've tried to pick that and apply it to my personal life as well. You know, just ditching whatever, you know, weird toxic relationship I'm into. Just, you know, stop that and just keep looking for better opportunities or for better people to hang out with. Or, you know, I didn't know that was an option. I don't know how to explain it, but I was very close-minded.
No, it's very clear.
You know, I was very, like, in my bubble. You know, I didn't like to go outside of that. But then I realized I'm missing so much. And I want to be more open and I want to meet more people. And Jesus, the moment I moved here, I'm like, holy fuck. There's everybody here is just like
Yeah, the talent. That's one of the things. I occasionally have these moments of weakness where I wonder if it would be worth moving somewhere else, because there's a lot of extraneous things. LA does, in certain respects, kind of feel like a city in decline. You know, we've got a lot of problems that keep seemingly getting worse, while simultaneously it gets more expensive. And, you know, my work is almost never actually in LA. I don't record the orchestra here very often, for example. I'm far more frequently in London or in Nashville or in Eastern Europe. And I love working in those places is the thing. Like, I love, it's what a dream to go to London and record, you know, at Air or Abbey Road or something. It's like, that's the best version of this career in so many respects. But I also have, there's such a magic about going into the Warner scoring stage, you know, and know, like, holy crap, John Williams recorded Close Encounters in this room. Or you go to Fox and you go, Jerry Goldsmith recorded Star Trek in this room. Or you go to Sony and they go, like,
I remember the first time you took me to like a recording session that was The Simpsons, and I was feeling like, holy shit, this is so.
Yeah, we were at, that was at the Bridge, and it was Alf Clausen. It's like, there's the guy that has personally written something like 600 episodes of The Simpsons.
Oh my god!
And it was it won an Emmy for that, and has about 1,000 other Emmy nominations. And
that was his last collaboration, right? His last.
The session we went to was one of the very last sessions before they actually fired him. And after like 30 seasons of service. It was a kind of a bit of a public mess. He actually sued them for firing him. And, I think he recently actually withdrew the lawsuit. He was essentially accusing them of ageism. They felt. He was accusing them of firing him for being too old, and he basically sued them for that.
Oh.
But then I don't know what happened. I'm pretty sure he basically tried to cancel the lawsuit. I don't know what it is exactly. I don't know the details, and I steered clear of the gossip of it. But there's no question that Bleeding Fingers, which is one of Hans Zimmer's companies, that's who took over the scoring for The Simpsons. So you see a lot of exchange between the Hans Zimmer camp on the current credits of The Simpsons. Yeah.
I have no idea how different it sounds. I've never passed more than, you know, 10 seasons.
Yeah, well, and it's literally, it's like starting at season 32 or something. I mean, it's really, really, really recent. But yeah, well, the point I was making was that LA, the ambient creativity of LA is so through the roof. I remember the first time I ever hung out with Amin in his old apartment that he was living in when I first met him. The first thing he said was, you know, one block from here around the corner is where Stallone was living, where he wrote Rocky.
Jesus.
And I remember it's like every corner of Los Angeles has some story like that, you know, has some moment. Like in that same neighborhood is where the Henson lot is, which used to be Charlie Chaplin's lot. And I love that you walk in the lot and in the concrete his footsteps doing the tramp walk that he did while the concrete was wet, and it's still there. It's very faint because rain and all that for the last 50 years has like degraded it, but you can see footsteps that Charlie Chaplin himself made in the wet pavement
while they were
constructing
filming.
It or something. That's I imagine awesome. He did it as a memento, when you lay concrete like in front of the Hollywood Chinese Theater where they have all the handprints. I think it's a similar gesture. It wasn't by mistake. It was done as a memorial kind of thing.
I see.
But it's his footsteps that he made, and you can see him and touch him. And people are. The thing that I love about it, in that particular instance, is it's behind the closed doors of the lot, which means it's not a tourist attraction. The people who see that every day are the people who are still working on that lot. Like they're like in the same way that the Warner Brothers lot is just being used as a. They make stuff there. It's an unbroken chain. Yeah. Like one time, another great example, because where I am right now in Burbank, the Warner lot is 5 minutes away. It's really close. I mean, I could basically walk there. And Warner Brothers, being the studio that owns the Batman franchise, one day I was just driving on my way to have lunch or something, and the Batmobile from the Christopher Nolan movies just drove past me.
That's
like they were
crazy.
They were it's a drivable car, like it's like a custom build thing for the shots, but that the crate, it's the like the tumbler or whatever they call it, it's that Batmobile that almost looks like a tank that you know, from the from Batman Begins and whatever, the one that Lucius Fox, played by Morgan Freeman, builds for him. It just drove off the lot past me. Presumably they were moving it into storage somewhere or something. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like it was doing a stunt. It was just in traffic. But I just thought, where else in the world would something like that happen?
And even now that you said doing a stunt, I've seen that. I've seen that walking canvas. I've seen that out there. Like just people filming, I don't know, whatever, you know, like it could be a commercial, it could be a movie, it could be like a
music video or students,
like short film. Yeah, even students, like everybody here, they're just trying to make art. And I love that. I didn't realize what I was getting into when I moved here. But I love
that. Yeah, and that's the thing that always keeps me here.
Even I know that there's a lot of people that think the SLA, like nobody cares about anybody else. They just care about their career. But it's actually quite inspiring. Anyway, if you even think that is pretty awesome.
You will occasionally meet people that are like that, but they, in my experience, they are absolutely the exception. They are not the rule. It is, people care so deeply. That's why I loved The Offer that we watched about The Godfather, because when you watch that and you see that everyone was trying to do a good job, like those scenes where Coppola and the cinematographer are fighting and yelling at each other, and the production designer who's, you know, talking about the lighting and the like with the DP and the composition, and they keep saying, I want it to feel like Caravaggio and light on their face in a very specific way, and he's going on and on, and he's like screaming, you know, it must be this way. Mm-hmm. It's not because he's an asshole, it's because he cares so much about the art of this film, and he's like willing to die for it. And so is the other guy. The other guy's trying to do his job to the best of his ability. And they're in conflict because they have a slightly different vision. But it's not because one is just like trying to somehow ruin it for the other. Again, occasionally there are people that are assholes. But the overwhelming majority are, you know, just eager to do a good job, hoping that it's an investment in something, you know, in whatever could come next. It doesn't matter what it is. It's very...
Yeah, at the end, I think at the end, the point is to pick your battle, you know, just to not make conflicts that don't actually, you know, in order to make a good product, in order to have a great project, whatever it is, if you are collaborating with others, you probably have to give away some of your ideas and just know that it's not going to be always as you want it to be. And that sometimes you think this is the best way to do it, but you might be wrong.
Oh, yeah. That's a lesson that so many young composers need. I see it all the time in these Facebook groups and things that I'm on where young composers ask questions. And one of the ones that comes up all the time is, what do you do when the director of a project is giving you notes that you know for a fact is going to make the music less and therefore make the game or the film or whatever less? And the question to always respond to that with is, what makes you so certain that they are making it worse? How do you suddenly know how to direct and compose? You know, what makes you think your insight is so superior to theirs that rather than go, let's try it. I remember the one time I ever did any work with another composer, really, like working for them, supporting them, was this one time I worked for like two or three days with, like working for a composer. The Order was a collaboration, a very equal partnership with Jason Graves. There was a movie called, I'm suddenly forgetting the name of the movie. But it was, Danny Elfman was doing the score. And I remember Laura Engel called me and said, you know, Danny has been hired at the last minute to replace another composer on this movie, and he needs help. His normal team is not available or something like that. Would you be willing to step in and help him? It ended up being a very short, quick in and out thing. But I went and got to spend the day with him at his studio, where he showed me all the music he had written up to that point to kind of like teach me what he was doing, because then I was going to go and write music and send it to him, and he was going to like give me notes, and I was going to basically kind of help write music to kind of get this thing over the line. And something that he said, when he's starting a film, he'll look at like the opening credits or whatever, and he'll write like five versions. He'll try to think of every conceivable different approach. Like, what if it's big and loud? What if it's quiet? What if it's fast? What if it's slow? And he'll write multiple versions and then just give them to the director and go, pick your favorite. And that blew my mind, because I always worked the opposite. I would put all my energy into this thing that I was like, it's perfect. I have, like, there's a vision. I can tell you, I want it to be like this and this, and here's why, and I have a reason, and I've spent all this time obsessing over your movie or your game, and I've digested it, and I know it just as well as you do, and here's why it should be like this. But of course, sometimes they go, oh yeah, no, I don't think it should be like that at all. And then you're stuck. And he had this very amazingly collaborative, like, no, I want them to kind of guide me. They're the director. I was like, God, this is Danny Elfman. This isn't some nobody. Like, it was such an egoless approach and so collaborative. Yeah. It blew me away. I never knew. And I've tried doing that over the years directly because of that conversation. And it's so effective.
That's awesome.
Where you learn to, first off, you learn to let go and not get super precious and uptight and stuff. But it also, it shows a trust to the director, and they'll reciprocate most of the time that trust, where if you go, you know, I really believe it needs to be this, and you really do genuinely feel strongly, they are much more likely to go, then I trust you. I believe in your judgment, because the whole relationship has been built on this give and take. You know, this whole collaborative partnership is about the back and forth. I just had it with this project I'm not allowed to talk about yet, but this TV show. There were plenty of moments where the showrunner would, I would say, I think it needs to be this. He'd go, I have a thought here. And I go, well, let me explain to you why I didn't do it that way. And then at the end of the conversation, there was a good chunk of the times where he'd go, honestly, I trust you more than my own instincts on this one. If you believe strongly enough, I'm gonna get out of the way. And then that puts a pressure on me to go, I better believe what I just said, because he's gonna let me do it. And if his version was better, it's gonna be my fault that it's not as good as it could have been.
Yeah.
So and I love that. I love this, you know, the respect and the mutual investment and all that. And yeah, it's one of the things people have a very certain idea of what Hollywood is or what the game industry is or any of those kinds of things. And I see a lot of negativity on Twitter about everything. Mm-hmm. It's like it's represented as if it's this blood sucking, you know, people at the top are just milking the people at the bottom dry and being very predatory. And I'm like, look, I have not seen every conceivable type of scenario. And yes, sometimes it's hard.
You've been here for a long time already. I think you have a very good sense of...
I've seen enough, and or I've talked to people who've seen it all. Like, I talked to a Richard Kraft type who've been there for everything you can imagine, from the biggest to the smallest to the most, you know, the biggest failures to the biggest successes. And I've heard, I feel like I've got a pretty realistic view, the people that have gotten really jaded and cynical about it, I think, tend to be the types that just kind of want to see the negative side, or their skin was not thick enough where when something really genuinely crappy happened to them, they just let it consume them, and then others tend to just go, well,
but that's everywhere.
Of course,
that's not only absolutely here. It's everywhere. It's literally. Yesterday, I wrote on Facebook something. This is a little personal, but I was like, you know, I feel like I should reconnect with this specific person that I haven't spoke in years. It was a good friend, but you know, life. And then I enter to their profile and I see like all this negativity and all this like, you know, things that I'm not
from
interested
that person,
in reading or. From that person, yes. And I was like, you know what? Some people never change. I better just not start anything here, because I'm very good as where am I. And I know that I can just build another relationship with a better person instead, you know, instead of just giving my time to somebody.
Yeah,
like
and
that.
Some people, that a version of that comes up a lot on the subject of networking, like when trying to find work. Some people, especially when you're first starting and you just need any job, it's like, if I get a bad vibe from someone, I have to kind of bite my tongue because I want the job more than I care about the red flag. And I'm always trying to right. kind of encourage people to say, it's actually okay to not feel like every person in the world is your soulmate. And some people are, right. it's okay to let them go. It's okay to let mm-hmm. them find someone else to work with who they're going to connect with. You know, like there's some people yeah. that are just a different fit, you know? And for me, I'm the same yeah. as you in what you just said specifically of, someone who's real bent out of shape and negative all the time, I won't last long with, because I, mm-hmm. on the one hand, I'm 99% of the time very optimistic, to the point that you've even been like, I think you're being very naive, because
too much.
Yeah, like I can be pretty bright-eyed, radical optimism
yeah.
about things, because I want to see the best in the world, but I also don't think it's irrational to see the best in the world. It's not that I'm trying yes. to be deliberately ignorant. I think there's the overwhelming majority of reasons to celebrate, and that when you see a negative thing in the world, most of the time, you know, you can react to it in a way that's productive and positive, or just do your best to just let it go and not let it bother you. But on top of mm-hmm. that, in those occasional fleeting times when I've really indulged cynicism or really let myself get negative,
it's like Homer eating that sandwich that went bad days ago and he keeps eating
it. I know, it's so
true.
You
know, he's like so into this relationship with the stupid sandwich and he's making him feel so sick, but he still eats it even knowing that it makes him
actually is a
so
great analogy
shitty.
It's true. It can be difficult to let go sometimes of a thing.
And uh-huh, exactly.
Richard Kraft has a great thing where he goes, when something really crappy happens to you, say the following three words: shit, fuck, next. He goes, it's okay to process feeling bad.
Yeah.
But like try to let it pass. Like do whatever your process needs, but
yeah, move on.
You know, as soon as you start focusing on the next thing, it's going to lose its power over you.
Exactly, exactly.
Another thing that I've learned from this business is no matter how difficult a day I've had, very likely someone has been dealt a far worse hand, to remind me that overall I need to remember to be lucky. Perfect example, I have a good friend who's a composer who spent the last, I don't know, a year writing music for this Batgirl movie that they just full on killed uh-huh. it. This like yesterday or today.
Yep, I saw.
Yeah,
that's so weird. Yes. Yesterday they said, okay, it's not gonna be anymore, and today they
yeah.
said X reason.
But they felt like it just couldn't measure up to the other DC films. Like it basically, they had budgeted it too low to be the kind of like over the top spectacle that you would expect of a major character alongside like Batman and Aquaman, right. and these are all like $200 to $300 million movies. This movie was under $100 million. So even though it was pretty good, and not to mention that Michael Keaton was coming back playing Batman in this movie, so it was like super intriguing, and a lot yeah. of people were definitely going to check it out on account of that alone. Brendan Fraser was the bad guy, which had
what?
People excited because he's like been kind of out of the business for a little mm-hmm. while and was starting to come back into it. And so it had all this curiosity around it, but Warner Brothers looked at it and said, basically, unless we were to go spend like another $100 million and try to reshoot half the movie, this is just me going off their public statement.
Yes.
This is no insider information. This is just reading the article in Variety.
Uh-huh.
Their opinion was basically, we're better off cutting our losses at the relatively low budget than spending a huge amount and risking
trying
it
to fix.
Be a big failure. Because it can be pretty hard to like take a movie that's not what you want and make it part way.
Yeah.
It's like if you're in a plane that's flying and you decide you want it to be a helicopter, it's pretty hard to rebuild it while it's in the air.
Yeah,
you've
yeah,
kind of
yeah.
got whatever it is. And that's just a tough road that a lot of, but I think this is now the highest budget canceled film in Hollywood history.
That's crazy.
Cause they had definitely spent close to $100 million.
Wow.
And usually you don't cut and run at that point. So, but that's like this composer friend of mine, you know, this is a big deal movie for her. And it's like, that just sucks.
Yeah.
You know, it just sucks. And but, you know, she'll hopefully have her, I haven't talked to her in any detail about it, but hopefully she'll be able to have her kind of shit, fuck, okay, now next.
Yeah, it really makes you feel bad about, like, everybody involved. It sucks.
Like, years of your life working on a thing that will never be seen now.
Oh, so sad.
It's a real bummer. But I get it. I mean, I actually think Warner Brothers, from what I read, assuming what they said is true, it doesn't strike me as an irrational decision on their part. It doesn't strike me as, like, if you know the movie is going to make fans disappointed because Wonder Woman and all the others set the bar here, and if you're looking at it just objectively going, it's not this spectacle the way those movies are. I can understand going, yeah, I don't think this is a good idea. Like, I can sympathize with that. That's not them being assholes or something, or, like, weird, greedy.
Yep.
Because I saw a lot of folks on Twitter that are like, you know,
blaming
stupid
them.
Warner Brothers. Yeah. And I'm like, try to see from it. It's devastating. It's heartbreaking. And it wasn't the only movie they killed, by the way. Another guy I know, a very wonderful guy. I think you actually met him at Richard's wedding. Tony Cervone, who directed that Flintstones movie I worked on years ago. He was directing a Scooby-Doo movie that was almost done. That also, he wrote a post on Instagram that was like, I'm beyond heartbroken. We were so close to finish. The movie was almost done. And I had no, obviously I didn't work on that film, but I have worked with him in the past, and he's a really nice guy, and he's like a hardworking, he's worked for Warner Brothers for decades. And yeah, he had his movie just killed, like, right at the finish line. It sucks. They're trying to save money, I guess.
Yeah, that's crazy.
But yeah, those, and actually, to bring it back to the topic, those partnerships, that to me is in the end what gets you through that. Like, when you have something that goes really, like Paul Sollett, he and I have worked on projects that went great, and we've worked on projects that were really hard, and, like, where I see him being put through some really difficult situations. And the fact that we both know that we're there for each other, like, all, no matter what.
Bros before hoes.
Like, bros before death. Like, I would never throw him under the bus. I would never blame him. If I felt like the score turned out in a way that I wasn't happy with, I would never go, well, you know, the director just sucks or whatever. Because I see composers do that sometimes, and I'm like, but they're supposed to be your that's who you're investing in. That's the person that's supposed to be like your brother, your sister, your spouse almost. And I have that with him. I would do anything for him, and he would for me. He's had situations where he had to really step up and defend me, and he did. And I would for him. And so it's like, sometimes you do everything and it still doesn't turn out the way you want it to, but you know, like, we're still there for each other. That's that partnership. Mm-hmm. And I would do it again. And if he called me and goes, I got a movie, and to be honest, I'm really not happy with it, I'd still do it. I'd still do it with him because it's him.
Yeah.
You know, those partnerships, those relationships
are
what you come here looking for. At least that's why I
spending
moved to
spending your savings.
Yeah. I lived on the edge of bankruptcy, essentially. I mean, I was very lucky. I was never like a true risk at homelessness.
Right.
But I had no spare income.
You gave more than you should.
I went way over budget.
Mm-hmm.
I was literally 400% over budget.
Jesus.
On his first film, Grace. And it was the best decision I had made in my career up to that point. And it's one of the best I've ever made. Like, insofar as it communicated to him that I cared more about the quality of his film than about, like, my ability to buy, you know, a nice dinner this month or something like that. You know what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm.
I care more about the work we're doing. And it was so worth it. Plus, we recorded at Abbey Road. That was the reason why. It was like, we're going to, you know, it was just one session for 3 hours done remote, because it was like, if
I
fly there.
Is that the first recording session you did?
The first time ever at Abbey Road was on Grace.
Wow. Congrats.
Yep. And the clarinetist, it was all clarinets. And the bass clarinet who played on the Traveler Symphony came up to me and he goes, you know, we worked together like 14 years ago. And I said,
Jesus Christ.
David Fuest, you played on Grace. And he goes, I'll never forget that day. He goes, it was all bass clarinets. And none of us ever did a session like that. He goes, we all remember that day. And it was like, to be sitting there, I'm sitting there recording with the London Symphony, and to have the clarinetist tell me that, it was like, I was like, I said, I was a kid. I I was just blowing my savings. I didn't know what I was doing. Yeah, it was so such a special moment. And he and all the photos we have from that session were because he brought his son along and said, "Will you take photos of this?" Because I didn't think to hire a photographer of the session. And so if you look online, I can't remember his son's name, but the last name is Foist. The son was the credited photographer of like the few little behind the scenes shots that we got.
That is so cool.
From that day. Again, it's the same thing we're talking about. It's relationships.
Yes.
It's people.
For sure.
You know, meeting each other. And it's just so many moments. I loved one time John Williams came and gave a master class at USC for the composition program. And I got to sit in the room with me and 20 composers and ask him questions for an hour and a half. And Kenny Hall came in and sat in the back. And John Williams didn't know Kenny was in there. For those who don't know who Kenny Hall was, you go on IMDb, look up Ken Hall. He was Jerry Goldsmith's music editor on like almost 100 movies. And he worked with everyone. He worked with Oliver Schiffer. And he worked with Bill Conti. He worked with John Barry. He started under Lionel Newman at Fox. I mean, it's just unbelievable the life he had. One of the most amazing people I ever met in my whole life. So grateful to be so close with him the last decade of his life. And he worked with John Williams on two movies, one of which was E.T., the most just of all the movies to work with. I mean, thing is, there's so many you could say that about with John Williams, but Kenny just, to him, it was one of the most special experiences of his whole life, despite how close he was with Goldsmith. That time on E.T. with John Williams and Spielberg was a true life's highlight that he would talk about it with such passion. And so what was so cool, just again, in the spirit of this notion of relationships, all of the students are asking questions of John Williams. Like, it's a chance to ask John Williams questions. And I remember hand goes up in the back of the room, and John Burlingame was moderating the conversation, so he points, and it was Kenny. And so people kind of lean out of the way so John Williams can see who's asking the question. And I'll never forget the look on his face when he goes, "Kenny!" He just, it's like they hadn't probably seen each other in God knows how many years, but he immediately realized who was asking the question, and he lit up. And it was like, John Williams keeps a pretty measured tone, but you could see him be like, "Hey, I know you," and I wish I could remember what Kenny. I actually have the video. They had a little camera on a tripod recording that, and I should go back and rewatch it.
Is that the same reaction that Anthony Panther had?
It was the opposite. Yeah, I was in London earlier. I was in London earlier this week, and a dear friend is a conductor / bassoonist here in LA who was conducting a recording session of a different friend, a composer named John Everest, at Abbey Road for a new upcoming project. And when I saw that mutual friends of mine were working together and we're going to be at Abbey Road, I had a few hours to kill after my plane landed. So I said, "Hey, you mind if I come just hang out while you're recording?" And so they invited me in and I popped in. They were in Studio One, the big magic ultra enormous scoring stage, the first recording studio built in human history. And I was in the booth, and Anthony had already started the session, so he didn't know I was there. He knew I was coming to London because he knew about the concert, the proms, the video game proms.
Congrats! Show. Yay! First time ever for video game music.
It was really special. Very, very amazing concert to be a part of. But and they weren't able to go because they were recording. Their sessions went until 9:30, which is when the show ended. So they joined us for drinks after their session, and our concert ended about at the same time. So we all got to have drinks afterward, but I was able to pop in earlier, and when it was time to take a break, I said, "Do you mind if I be the guy to call it?" And they were like, "Sure." So I got on the talkback, and they were doing just strings, and then they were going to be doing brass and woodwinds in a separate session entirely. So the room was all violins, violas, cellos, basses. Anthony conducting, big group, sounded amazing. John wrote lovely stuff. Nolan Markey was the orchestrator. They were both there in the booth with me. And Jake Jackson was engineer. The talented, top tier folks. And so I just got on the thing and I said, "Maestro, it's all sounding really good and we're keen to take a break, but the bass sarousaphone is not coming through." I was trying to think, what's something that he'll know it's me instantly? Because that's a really weird, rare instrument.
What the hell did you just ask? Explain to me.
So it's a really weird, rare instrument that he bought on a whim, and he told me about it, and I was like, "We got to use it." So I brought him in on Banner Saga 3 to be a featured bass sarousaphone player, and I think I'm one of the only people that's ever asked him to use this instrument that he owns. So when I got on and I said, "The bass sarousaphone," from the podium in front of the whole orchestra goes, "Austin Wintory." He goes, "I'd recognize that high-pitched nasal voice anywhere."
Oh, what the fuck?
And he goes, I think my credit score just declined several points.
Wow. Which was,
I saw the whole orchestra craning to look into the booth. It was so funny. And then it was like, that's we're ready for our break. So they all went and had their coffee.
Oh,
or whatever,
my God. That is so...
Came in and gave me a big...
Jesus, I it made me laugh. Happy, it was, though.
It was like, oh, I mean, he's the kind of guy that would, you know...
Burn you.
Troll you. Yeah, yeah. No, it was... I laughed. I burst out laughing. Oh, and I can't deny it. I wish I had a voice like his. I do not. It was not a...
It's like hearing... I was going to say Simba, but it's not Simba. It's the other...
James Earl Jones.
Yeah.
Yeah, he has a voice... No, for real. Actually, Anthony, people don't know, he actually does occasional side work as a voiceover narrator kind of guy. Because
he
has one of those...
I had no idea. That's crazy.
He's got the voice for it. I mean, he has one of those...
So deep and very
pure
powerful.
Baritone.
Yeah.
And very and charismatic. Like, it's not just deep, but he can speak with flair. And
you have nasal voice though.
Oh, come on, it's all in good fun. But
oh my God.
Anyway, I think we have comments to read.
Yes!
Do we not?
We have. I don't know how to call this section, but I have 10 questions.
Yes, thank you to our lovely people for engaging with our social media and stuff, and actually writing stuff down when we put this call out. It's very kind.
Yes.
So you know me, I can easily make 20-minute answers out of everything.
Yes,
we'll be as quick as possible.
Time. Yes, let's try to be as quick as possible.
Do you want me to read them?
Yes, please, because I suck at it.
No, not at all, but I'm happy to do it. So the first one. Arvald Photo.
That's Anthony.
Different Anthony than
what
we're talking
Anthony.
About.
It's my Anthony.
Your Anthony.
Not yours.
from what you guys have experienced doing this podcast, what has been the easiest and most difficult things? Well, I know I'll just really quickly give my... The easiest thing is it's just talking.
Talking, it's, yes.
Yeah, it's
the
easy
to... The difficult is
like,
to make you stop.
Yes, the real test will be how much if you cut anything I just said, this would be...
Done with
will
that.
Be another one for people to yeah, yeah, no, but I don't just mean talking in general. I mean, it is fun to talk with you about these topics. That
honestly,
is easy.
I think for you it's just fun to talk to anybody. Like, but if we're
well,
if
I do have three podcasts, I guess. So
every time you talk about music, you're gonna be like over the moon, no matter who you're talking to. Even if it's just only Canvas, you're gonna be so happy anyway.
I mean, look, I can't deny that I chose this career out of a passion for this subject, so it's not... Yes, I love it naturally, but it's fun.
Oh, yeah.
It's fun to talk with you about this stuff, and I was going to say the most difficult part is the pragmatics of, like, I'm very aware now when I go to drink, I try to aim away from the microphone so you don't tell me about the ASMR
yes.
of my
so
drinking
much.
Coffee. I'm sure I failed many times today. Apologies.
I don't know yet,
advance.
But we'll see.
Similarly, my air conditioner is running. It adds noise in the background. I'm sorry. I try. It's just so hot.
No, no,
so,
it's okay. I don't
but those little things, that's
that
the only thing that's
but
difficult.
That's difficult for me because I am the one who has to edit all those things out.
Yeah, so. But that's what I mean. Like, this thing is overall so effortless feeling.
Yeah.
That's like the difficult, that's the only, it's like the little stuff.
Yeah, you're just being you. That's awesome.
Well, likewise.
The difficult part for me is to lose myself, you know, to follow the flow.
To relax,
because I've never done this before. And I'm, you know, I'm an amateur that actually being next to you, like doing this thing together.
We're both amateurs.
I don't know how to call you, but you have so much to say. And it's always so...
I got in trouble for that with my teachers in school as a kid. So it's good to be able to finally do something useful.
I know. At the beginning, it was a little intimidating because you know your shit. I'm like, just, you know, here, just trying to give my point of view. But I don't know many of the things you do. So for me, I guess that was the difficult part. Just being me, just trying to relax and yeah, I guess.
Well,
but
the very obvious
it's
thing.
It's actually easy with you. With other person, I think I will feel a little self-conscious.
Well, that means a lot that I could help you feel that way because I love your perspective. And I think when you say, I know my shit, I'm not to turn this into like a circle jerk, but you know more than you ever give yourself credit for. And even if it's a topic that's new to you, you often like will you don't just stare blankly. You immediately develop opinions and like or questions or whatever. And so it still could be an interesting conversation. That's why we did the show, because it was right. always like that, yeah. just having dinner and talking about something. So it was like, I guess yeah. let's turn the microphones on. Maybe it's interesting for other people too.
All right. Well, next question.
Brandon Lionhearted. What commonalities do you find in how you each approach your respective arts, and what was it about each other's arts that drew you towards one another? What's your answer to that?
What commonalities? What the hell is that? Like what's like, similar to you what you do and what I do?
I read it as, I read it as like almost like about technique. You know, in what ways do you paint similarly to how I compose? In some like conceptual level, we both I think are curious about trying new things. I think we both have a fairly strong sense of who we are, but we're also trying to stretch that definition. Like, I think when someone says that piece of music sounds like you, I like to hear that. I like when someone says that, in the same way that I see a painting of yours and I go, that's so you.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you don't want to just do the same thing over and over.
Right.
So the goal is, can I be constantly widening the definition of what it sounds like to be me or what it looks like to be you? I think that's something we very much have in common
mm-hmm. I see.
In what we do. You know what I mean? That's my answer.
I was trying to look for common things that we have, but I couldn't find an answer. But what was it about each other's art that drew you towards one another? I think Austin's excitement on creating new things all the time. He always had a project to do, and he always brings new ideas to the table, and that is probably the first thing that made me say I should collaborate with this guy. And yeah,
from my side, it was just the sheer impact on me of your talent. I saw your cosplay because of Twitter and was like, wow, she's I've seen a lot of cosplay just thanks to the internet, but this was a whole other, this is world class. I mean, this was like film studio costume design.
Well, thank you.
And then discovering the paintings and being like, that's like the real thing. That's like the art, the cosplay is kind of a hobby.
Uh-huh.
And I just found your work so expressive, you know, it felt, and so unpretentious. That was the thing that I loved. You know, I've been around a lot of, like art students that have a very, pretentious attitude about it ought to be like this and such as, you know, we talked about it a little bit in another episode. And I love that your work was just like, it reminded me very much of Sonia, who my cousin, who was a painter in her whole life, who died at age 90 a few years ago, who she just made things she thought were beautiful. Or Drew Struzan, the artist, I think I talked about him here as well.
Yeah.
Legendary painter of so many iconic movie posters, who said, I just wanted to put something in the world that made it a little bit more beautiful of a place.
That's awesome.
So like, there's no, I'm not trying to advance the art form or this or that or the,
mm-hmm.
even though ironically he probably did.
He did.
But that was not the goal. There was no pretentious sense of ego, and I felt that from your work. That it just felt like you were creating in a way because you didn't know how not to. And that was great. Next one, Greg Alex for Austin. Any funny anecdotes about a piece you've written, something you wrote by mistake, copy pasted something in the wrong place, or that ended up becoming final? I mean, I've got a million things like that where something went wrong.
Happy little accidents.
Happy accidents are very much a thing that have happened a million different ways. One random example that comes to mind is sometimes in older years, I had a computer that was kind of struggling and I would always push it too far and it was like old and couldn't quite handle it. And the software in those days was not quite as advanced as what I use now. And so one thing that could happen is I remember the software was like so overloaded with stuff. The music was so kind of complicated, or I had a lot of plugins operating or whatever, that if I went and saved it, if I hit like Control S, it would spin for like 20 seconds because it needed that much time to save. And I normally have this impulsive, like, I save constantly because I'm always paranoid. But when it slows me down that much, I stop doing it because I'm like, this is taking too long. I can't work. Every time I save, I have to sit here for like 20, literally imagine 20 seconds feels like a long time when you're in the zone. So I kind of stop saving. And then inevitably what happens, the software is already struggling. It crashes and I lose, like, I lose. And then I realize, holy shit, I hadn't saved in like 2 hours.
Been there.
A huge amount. Yeah, huge amount is gone. And then what happens is I go and I have to, I'm like, okay, I have to remember, what did I do? What did I do? And I go and I write it. And the thing that drives me crazy is that the second version is better. And I go, because I remember the good stuff. And everything else was like replaced with something better because I'm doing it again. And like, I'm like wiser by 2 hours.
You kind of like warm up further.
And exactly. And I always thought, if I had real courage, I would write a piece and then delete it and do it again because I know, now I already know that this makes it better.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have occasionally done that. I've gone and I've occasionally gone and written and then I go, okay, cool. And then I'll do.
That's crazy.
I will leave somewhat of a safety net. I'll do like save as, and then I'll delete everything where I can go back and check something if I want, but I don't. I rarely, because I'll just go, it's better now. And that's all born out of an accident.
What a luxurious way to work. That's,
well, obviously sometimes the deadlines make that suicide.
That's crazy.
Anyway, that's one example of a happy accident that really kind of like changed how I work.
Yeah, the question has a second part, and it's for me. It says, what happens if you make an error while painting? Can you brush it over? Have to start again? And it starts about that. Yes, I have basically painted white a full canvas, like a big oil painting of a portrait I disliked a lot of Big Boss from Metal Gear Solid. That was years ago, and it was huge. It was a huge painting, and I hated it. And I was like, okay, no, I need to start over. So I did. That was one of those like painful things because it was so much work, but it was needed. Because it's just fixable. It's just not fixable. It's like this Batgirl movie, you know, like you better just let it go.
Especially because sometimes you sit there, I've seen it, where you are trying to make it better and you're like for a day doing all these little modifications. And then that's what made you realize I can't fix that. I can't actually correct it.
Yeah.
It's not like you immediately jump to that conclusion.
Yeah, let's continue.
So James Ryan Cullen has also started folding his socks right. No. Christina H. Gore, do you have a dream project that you would work on, like a game or a movie or a show that I would want to compose for or for you, like, for example, a giant street mural? I mean, my sort of most true answer has always been my dream project is the kind of thing that I can't even imagine it until it shows up. Which is how it felt about Journey.
Mm.
I never could have imagined a game. And then when Genova described it to me for the first time as like, this is what we want to make next, I thought, I've never heard of anyone trying anything like this. I don't see how you're going to succeed. This seems impossible, but I'm in. That's like my dream. If every time a game comes along where I just go, I can't picture it. Like, let's try to make something truly new. That's my dream. But if you want a more obvious answer, I'm a huge, hardcore, obsessive Mass Effect fan. And if there was ever an opportunity to work on Mass Effect in any capacity, like the only franchise that's true for. Because most of the time I look at it and I go, like Bioshock. I'm like, Gary Shyman did such a good job. I would never want to like try to do what he did. I'd just rather hear Gary do another Bioshock score. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't normally have a good answer.
Yeah.
For that, like, I don't want to do a Star Wars game if what that means is I have to like rip off John Williams, for example. Like, I love Star Wars so much, but that's not really a dream to me. You know, I'd rather if it was like a Mandalorian situation where you could actually do something different, but that's very rare. So no, mostly I just go, I'd rather do new things. You know, that's exciting. But I do love Mass Effect so much.
For me, I guess now that they mention a giant street mural, I kind of like had that planted in my head once when I was asked to use my art for a mural in the offices of Sony. I think you remember that in London. I don't remember his name, but he worked there and he was like,
I vaguely remember this years ago.
That? Yeah, it was years ago. And I was like, how cool that would be, like, to have my... I don't remember what happened, but it didn't, like... I don't know, they changed the layout or whatever, and so it never happened. But
right.
That always stay there. Like, it could be nice to paint a big thing at some point. I guess that could be a good, pretty cool goal.
Sterling M. Oliver, when you start a Brushes and Keys performance, which I assume they mean, like, Dialogos, what are you feeling or thinking? Does one of you tend to be the one that goes first?
Oh, yeah.
We've kind of shaken it up.
I think we toss a coin.
Yeah, we've done that. We also, at least once, maybe more than once, asked the audience to just, like, say a few words, like an improv. I think it was in Croatia. I said, just name an emotion.
Yeah, yeah. A couple words, and then we start from there.
We just start from there. I think it's... From a practical standpoint, it's easier for me to start because I can start creating a mood basically the instant I touch the piano because it immediately is a thing. But a canvas, you know, a single brush stroke doesn't become something beyond just a brush stroke in the same way that two or three notes in a row can already almost feel like a melody. So I can get to an emotion faster, I think, on the piano. I think music just has, like, an unfair advantage in that way. So I think I've probably started more than not because it would take a few minutes of just silence, of watching the canvas before it starts to, like, look like a thing that I can play with, potentially. So it's a little asymmetric, I would argue. But we've done it every way, and I love always changing.
Yes, for sure. Are you ready to do it on MacFest next time?
Yeah, let's do that's
if as safe as there possible.
And plenty others. Yeah. That Irish sorcerer, I like that name. This is for you. Why did you move to America? What do we have to offer you? I like that the Irish sorcerer is the what do we have to offer? That made you choose it as your home, and you're not allowed to say it's because of me.
that is not fair. I guess. What I was saying before, you know, like this is a great place full of opportunities for an artist. If you are a creative person, LA is a very good spot to develop your career. So I guess that's my excuse, but honestly, it's because of you.
Well, and I remember when we did that very first MAGFest and you sold a bunch of prints and paintings and stuff, and you were like, this is the most I've ever sold in a day. This wouldn't be physically possible in Costa Rica. Like, people just don't spend this kind of money on a thing on that stuff here. And it felt like it was more financially viable as an artist in the U.S.
It was the first taste of working together or of doing this thing with you, plus being compensated by it, by fans. Like, they liked the painting and they just immediately bought it. That was like, I've never seen that before.
For hundreds of dollars. Like, literally people...
Yeah.
After the Dialogos, there were people who were dropping hundreds of dollars on an original painting right there in front of you, which was a new experience.
Like cash, like in the moment. It was insane. And I was like, holy fuck, this is, wow, okay. I like this. I want to do it again.
I mean, I'm a believer in people, you know, like when I buy something, the premise is I want that thing, whether it's a meal, a piece of art, a concert, whatever. I want that experience more than I want this money. That's the whole point of a transaction. Like, this is worth more to me than the money. That's just why I'm willing to give the money for it.
Yeah. What I love the most is that they were willing to do that because they experienced the journey of the painting and the music together. So they, I think we affected them at that point, you know,
I remember them saying, it was a couple, they bought it and they said, we like to buy stuff that has a story, and the fact that we can tell the story of watching this painting be made as a back and forth dynamic, totally improvised, they were like, it's such a great thing to have on the wall every time someone comes over, the painting is gorgeous, and then we're like, oh, actually, really cool story about why where we got this painting. Like, they wanted that to be on. It's not just something nice on the wall, though it is very nice. I never know how to say this. This is a friend. This is someone who's in my Discord, which if anybody's interested, it's available through my Bandcamp page, awesomewintry.bandcamp.com. Admittedly, it's mostly musicians and composers with nerdy talk, but all are welcome. I don't actually ever know how to pronounce this name, like Isomister. What made you guys choose to devote your lives to art and to music? And if you weren't, what would you be doing now? For me, I just instantly fell in love with it. When my childhood piano teacher, Derry O'Leary, exposed me to the music of Jerry Goldsmith, I went from, I've never heard of music, composing, any of that, to instantly, that's what I want to do. But the thing I already was passionate about was storytelling. I thought maybe I want to be a novelist. I thought maybe I want to be a video game designer. I was studying computer programming in high school, thinking I'll go and make video games because I want to tell my own stories through video games, or maybe make films, or, you know, at one point I thought, you know, I'll write novels and turn them into video games. Like, I loved the act of storytelling in the sense of, like, people tell stories to each other in that kind of almost mythology sense. That was really inspiring to me. And the idea that music could be a part of that, I was pretty much sold, and I've never even contemplated if it was the right decision. I have often said, if I fall out of love with music, I'll do something different. Like, it's okay. But it certainly hasn't been at risk of that. That said, what would I be doing if not that? My big love outside of music is like science and physics and philosophy and the interweaving of those things. You know, the way that the more we learn about the fabric of the universe, the more it can teach us about our role in the universe, which can then have downstream effects on kind of bigger picture life philosophy. And I love all of that. I find that very beautiful. And I could easily see making a career in that somehow. You know,
yeah.
I don't know what exactly that would mean. Like, the grand is like an Alice Roberts type who goes on TV and tells you how beautiful nature is, or Neil deGrasse Tyson.
That's cool.
That would be a dream job.
Have all the potential, honestly. You have the knowledge and also have the charisma to just go out, you know, on TV and do your thing.
I wouldn't presume so. But that's why we made Light in the Void, is because it was cool. Basically like, what are my two biggest loves? Is science and music.
Yeah, for sure. Well, what made me choose this? It wasn't like an accident, because I've always been very creative, but until Austin came to my life, I didn't take art seriously, you know? Like, I never saw myself just working on art for a living. Like, that was never an option for me living in Costa Rica. So, I don't know. It was something like, I just thought it was now an option, so I decided to go for it. And I'm on it, you know? I'm in the process of, you know, just trying to do it and getting there.
And if not this, then what?
If not this, I will be probably passionate about interior design, so maybe that will be, I like that.
My prediction was going to be something with dogs, like someone who takes care of strays and finds homes for them, or like, you could be very happy, I think, making your whole life about the well-being of animals and dogs in particular.
I could see you
building a very successful business, honestly, off of that, because it comes from a very real place for you.
Yeah, no, I know, but I don't know. I'm just thinking on the creative aspect, because yes, dogs are always.
Of course.
Yeah, but no, I guess that, because I will probably say also, I don't know, biologist. I always felt so.
Huh.
Yeah.
I like that
since I was, you know, a little girl. I used to watch a lot of National Geographic, and that stuff. I just love it, and I've always felt like I should be a biologist. I should be a explorer or
marine biologist like George Costanza.
Exactly.
Michael Seraph Piano says, how much does your own art profit from the inspiration of the others? Obviously, when we work together in a huge way.
Yeah.
I also really love, like in the case of the Traveler Symphony, really excited working on the music, picturing you making the album art. Like, that that actually is like a motivator.
Yeah.
And but also in just day-to-day life, I work from home. I work from the studio. You work from home.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's always really a joy to come home after having just spent 12 or 14 or 16 hours or whatever writing music or doing things related to my career, to then come home and instead of just like going to bed and dying and collapsing or whatever, mm-hmm. very often you, as soon as I walk in the door, you'll show me what you've been doing all day. And so it's like, I love that. I so love that because it is, it's like going from a high of my job into this different world where I see totally different creativity and different choices and different challenges. And instead of like, if I came home, like if we were both composers and I came home
right.
and you were like, so today I had this and this and that, and it all sounded like the same stuff I've yeah. been doing all day, absolutely. That would be so much less interesting. yeah, and or it'd be annoying. You know,
I know
it'd
there
be
are like, relationships that actually work. But I will feel exactly the same. It would be very weird and tiring to have the same job.
I've always been baffled by the composer friends of mine that are in relationships with fellow composers. I mean, I get it because they understand each other in ways mm-hmm. that few others could. I totally get that part of it. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love the variety that, you know, because yeah. it's different enough that it's, yeah. I relate to it, I understand it, but it's obviously nothing I could
absolutely.
All right, grand finale. Bodies 07. Curious how Brushes and Keys experience, presumably the experience of making this podcast, has been for each of you, with Angela coming from exclusively visual medium and Austin coming from exclusively auditory medium. Do you find that you think about your collaborations differently than you would? Also for Austin, yes. How does that feel? How does that process compare to working on game development? I mean, I feel like basically we've kind of already addressed
this yes.
50 mm-hmm. different ways. I'm a different composer because of you in my life than I would be without you, because I have this constant artist making me think about art in a more broad way than just like the little bubble of music. I'm literally living with an artist who is doing a different type of art from me. And if my only thinking about art all day was music, like art, I don't mean visual art, I mean art, all the arts.
Mm-hmm.
If the only contact I had on a day-to-day basis was my art,
mm-hmm.
Then I would only see it through the lens of my art. But instead, I get to see what you do, and then it sparks all kinds of thoughts. And obviously, we're always like, What if we tried this, or what if we did right. that, or what if, you know, like, and I wouldn't be thinking on these what ifs
mm-hmm.
if you weren't there. I wouldn't be sitting there thinking of interesting collaborations with a painter if I wasn't yeah. talking to
I
a painter all day.
I feel
day.
Like our collaboration feels very much like when, do you remember Remy tasting a piece of tomato and cheese together? Like that feeling that he gets, like all the flourish images around.
Oh, Remy from Ratatouille.
Yes. I think that is what this collaboration feels
analogy.
To me. Feels very much like it's two different things, but together they can be really, really tasty.
Yep, I totally agree. I hope that's a satisfying answer for Bodies 07, because I feel like we could kind of do a whole episode in a way about that question.
I know this being a little long, but yeah, I am so grateful for everybody who actually participated on this like first Q&A.
Yeah, really, thanks for leaving those.
Yeah. That's awesome. And, we were supposed to give a album of the day, and I'm just going to name it. And because we were talking about relationships, album of the day is Duets from Frank Sinatra. And I picked that one because, yes, it's all about songs in collaboration with a lot of other artists.
I don't actually know any behind the scenes on that specific album, but after you mentioned it, I went and looked it up. And it is a pretty unbelievable, like, who's who of that time in terms of duetting, Sinatra duetting with Streisand, Aretha Franklin,
yeah.
you know, Gloria Estefan, Tony Bennett. It's pretty unbelievable of a lineup. But also on the behind the scenes of Nelson Riddle's collaboration, like, people from my world know Nelson Riddle as the guy that wrote Batman. But he was also Sinatra's orchestrator and like those legendary string lines and things behind a lot of these. Like Nelson Riddle is a god, and so it's like his name on a bunch of these tracks alongside, you know, Quincy Jones, Pat Williams. It's a pretty serious piece of work, that record. I'd forgotten.
What I didn't like about this is that supposedly he recorded himself separated from this
alone.
Alone. So they had to respond to his... I'm not sure what was the process, but it was all separated. Like, he didn't interact with them at any point. So I guess that's a little... Yep.
That's hilarious. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's a little funny. And it supposedly got a lot of criticism because of that. But
that's so funny.
Yeah.
I
it's like what you're doing right now with Stray Gods, I guess. You know, you have the recording of each actor.
Believe me, it's not what we wanted to do. It's just a technical necessity because of the way it's complicated nature of, like, if the player chooses this, then the character can say that. But if they choose this, then they can say that. And to organize it and to get through it all, it would be so tedious. It would have required quadruple the amount of time if the actors were all in the room together, you know? Like, it's just impossible to afford.
Exactly. I was going to say, that's probably one of the reasons. It's probably, I don't think it was like ego or anything like that. I think it was mostly just...
I mean, he was a pretty ego guy. Like... Sinatra was amazing, and, you know, he deserves a lot of worship, but he was also, you know, like, I'm pretty sure that Frank's portrayal of him in The Offer is not pretty, I think it's pretty spot on.
Yeah, maybe. I just don't want to, obviously, I don't want to say much because I don't know much, but I hope that it was mostly for, you know, technical reasons and not much about his ego, but yeah. I just love him so much.
I mean, look, he's a god. He's a musical legend. He's right up there with the other, you know, the greats, the Michael Jacksons, the Beatles, there are very few groups that I think will forever be kind of synonymous with the 20th century music itself. Yeah. You know, like, a name like Frank Sinatra is as important to the history of the art of music as, you know, name him, Beethoven. Like, it sounds over the top to make a comment like that, but I think if you were to make a list of, like, the 1,000 most, or not even say the 200 most important people to have ever influenced music, I don't see how you couldn't put Sinatra on that list.
Absolutely.
I mean, how many billions of people
are
they the heart and soul of their, you know, like, their life, their
totally.
You know, they played his music when their kid was born, or they walked down the aisle at the wedding to it. Like, It
forms a central part.
My life. I didn't do those.
People do that with your music.
Oh well, I mean, look. Whenever I've gotten an email from someone like that, it is the single highest. No award can compare with an email like that,
so
because it's so personal. And he's like that for billions, or at least hundreds of millions.
Anyway,
all right, goodbye, everybody.
Yeah, goodbye.